going to start it off. It says the following: Yata Tetzaves Bnei Yisrael. You should command Bnei Yisrael. V'yichui lachashem ezayzach. You should take for yourself olive oil, pure olive oil. It says kasis lamaor, crushed for lighting, lahalos ner tamid, in order to light up like a continuous flame. Now, kasis really means that you take out all the sediment, meaning it can't just be olives that are, you know, that are squeezed together with the olives themselves, and then, you know, you have a little bit of the olive shell with it together and stuff like that. That actually you cannot use for lighting. What you have to do is you take the olive and you squeeze it, you make like even a little hole, and you have the oil come through. That's the only olive oil that you're allowed to use for lighting. Later on, you would squeeze it again. That oil would not be used for lighting at all, because you could have like little parts of the olive in it. That oil was used instead for menachos. And Rashi says it straight out. It says, the kosher, where is it? It says, shemen rishona, the first part of the shemen, is kosher for lighting. And it says, vashemen hasheni, the second part of the oil, pasul l'menorah. That's pasul for the menorah, but kosher l'menachos. It's kosher if you want to bring a flower offering. The flower offering required oil. You could use it for that. Shemar kasis lamaor. It's crushed, and that's what you use for lighting, below kasis l'menachos. But you did not use crushed oil for the menachos, for the flower offerings. Okay, Rav Shur says, you know, we obviously know that the ultimate and the best thing to do is to do mitzvos lishma. Meaning, if you do it l'shem shamayim, that by far is the greatest thing that you can do when it comes to mitzvos. But even if it's shalol lishma, we know what ends up happening if you do something shalol lishma. Eventually, bal lishma. It eventually becomes something that's lishma. There's a Gemara that says the following.
That olive oil that they use, what we would call extra virgin olive oil?
I would assume. I don't know how they define it. I think it's a higher level. I don't know what they use for extra virgin olive oil. But this is literally just take the first bit of oil that comes through, and that's considered the olive oil, and that's that. So I don't know how they make the other olive oils.
Is this the same olive oil that caused all those problems, Hanukkah?
Yes. We're going to get to Hanukkah in just a couple minutes. That's going to be exactly what the issue is going to be. The Gemara says the following. My Mininba, for those that are miyamin, who want to make, like, put their right hand into it, who want to do it in the right way, then the Torah becomes a samadachai. If you learn Torah in the correct way, with your right hand side, so to speak, the whole Torah becomes a samadachai, meaning an elixir of life. Not a poison. The poison's not the right word for it. Something that you have for life. While if you're masmi'ilin ba, if you use your left hand, you're doing the Torah in the left-handed way, then it's called a samada musa. It's called a poison that can kill you. Now, the problem is the following. Yamin refers to doing things lishma. Left refers to doing things shalo lishma. So I can understand, you do it on the right hand side, you do it lishma, then it's going to be a samadachai, it's going to be an elixir for life. That I completely get. But you're going to tell me that if you do things shalo lishma, it's death? How can that be? How can it possibly be that you do something shalol lishma, it's going to kill you? There's no way. And we just said shalol lishma eventually brings you to do something lishma. So how could that be? So here's what Rav Shur says. There are two parts, two things that happen when a person learns Torah. One thing that happens is you have a koach, that Torah gives you a koach to have life. That it gives you an ability to live your life better, and you feel a little bit better about yourself. That's the first thing that Torah does. But there's a second thing that Torah does. It also saves you from the Yetzer Hara. That if you sit there and you learn Torah, you have an ability to get yourself away from what the Yetzer Hara is making you do. You can throw, you won't be affected by the Yetzer Hara as badly. Those are the two parts to what this can be. So here's what it is. If you're Miyamin Bun, you do something Lishma, then the Torah is the koach to give you life. That's the Sama Dechaya. It is the ability to give you Chiyas, a real, like, an ability to do things in this world. That's what Lishma can do. It can make you feel awesome about learning and make you want to learn more and more and more. That's if you do it Lishma for its own sake, it makes you want to do more Torah. That's the idea behind Lishma. Shalom Lishma means it's a Sama Demusa. It's an elixir that takes away death, and that's it. It doesn't make you feel better. It doesn't give you the elixir of life. What it does is it allows you to destroy the Yetzer Hara. It's Megin Umatzil. It's able to protect you and it's able to save you from death. But it doesn't allow you to have life. That's what happens if you learn Shalol Lishma. Even Shalol Lishma saves you from evil. Because in the end, if you do something Shalol Lishma again and again and again, and you keep doing something Shalol Lishma again and again and again, eventually the Yetzer Hara is knocked down so much that it ends up becoming Lishma. You don't have Yetzer Hara anymore. When you don't have Yetzer Hara anymore, you start learning Torah for the correct reasons. That's the best thing about it. That's why Shalol Lishma will lead you to become Lishma, because it knocked down Yetzer Hara to the point where you can do it for the right reasons. The menorah is a perfect remez to the aura of Torah and Chachmah. The menorah with its lights and everything is supposed to represent the Chachmah of Torah. the oil that you put inside the menorah is the wisdom of a person. It's the machshava of a person, the thoughts of a person that go into it. Torah is required to be shemen zayizach. Your thoughts have to be pure. Meaning the greatest way to learn Torah, the way for the menorah to give off light and for it to become something for you, is for it to be lishma. Fully lishma, without any psoas in the machshava, without any sediment inside there that's making you think the wrong things, that's making you do the wrong things. That's what it means by if you have it kasis lamaor, if it's crushed without any of the sediment in there, it's used for light. That gives you chayim. However, you don't need kasis lamunachos. What's a mincha? A korban mincha, it's not really a korban because there's no animal involved, it's a flower offering, but a mincha is brought as a kapara for a person. As an atonement for where a person is. If a person does something wrong, then a mincha is brought as an atonement to be able to get rid of your sins, to get rid of your yetzahara. That doesn't require shemen zayizach. In order to do a kapara, you're just taking away death. You can allow the Torah to be shalolishma. If it's shalolishma, you can have sediment inside there. It doesn't have to be the purest olive oil, like the virgin oil as you were talking about before, Binyamin. It can be the second best olive oil. That's good enough. That's what it means by kasis lama or, but you don't need kasis lama nachos. And here's what you brought up before, Yoel. There are two chagim midrabanan. Two chags that we add on to our chagim midrabanan. Obviously we know about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuos. But then we have two chagim that we hold of midrabanan, Chanukah and Purim. Chanukah was all about the Shemen Tahor. As we all know, they were looking for the purest olive oil to be able to bring to the menorah that they brought into the base of Mikdash. That's what it was all about. It was all about the light. Why? Because the whole chag of Hanukkah is a chag of l'shem shamayim. They didn't fight because they wanted to save their lives. No. The Greeks never wanted to kill them. They fought only for the purpose, for the right to learn and to be able to act in the ways of the Torah and not just live empty lives. That's what they were fighting for. They were fighting for God. A fight for God means it's a lishma holiday. So the or that was used, the way to represent it is the shemen zayizach, the or that was there. It's not just coincidence that the eighth parsha in Shmos is Tetzava, and the eighth word in the parsha is the word Shemen. It's not just coincidence that way. It always works out that way. Because the 8 days of Hanukkah is an obvious remez that we're trying to refer to over here. But that's the concept. Purim is just the opposite. Those who remember Megillah, Daptez Zayin Amud Aleph, remember that Haman went to go tell Mordechai that he was going to be brought through the streets and he's going to wear the king's clothing on top of him. He's going to be put on a horse and they're going to read out Kacha Yeseliish Asher HaMelech Chafetz Bikaro. They're going to lead him through the streets. When Haman came to see Mordechai, Mordechai was teaching the Rabbanan a halacha. Anybody remember what he was teaching them? It's a crazy Gemara. Hilchos Kemitza. He's teaching them Hilchos Kemitza. How to do Kemitza in a Korban Mincha. What do you do? And he showed them. You take the flour, you hold it up in your fingers like that, and that's considered the Kemitza. That's the regular Kemitza. The rest of it is considered Shirayim and everything like that. And he's teaching them. And Haman asked him, what are you learning? And Mordechai told him, we're learning about Hilchos Kemitza for what you need in the base of Mikdash. And Haman said, Asa Mali Kumsi Kimcha Didhu, your handful of Kemach that you have in your hands was Dochi Alpi Kikari Kisva Didi. It was Dochi the 10,000 silver pieces that I gave over to Achashverosh. The fact that you learned these things destroyed every bit. Purim had a little bit of Tumah in there. It's an idea behind the Menachos because it required a bit of Tumah. There was no Geula after the Chag of Purim. There was no Geula. Achashverosh was still our king. Esther was still married to a non-Jew. Esther still had to be together with a non-Jew. It wasn't custis. It wasn't a pure olive oil mixture. There was something a little bit wrong. There was a little bit of sediment in there. And thus, it's custis, the lola menachos. Those are the two ramazim of Purim and Chanukah that are hinted to in the beginning of the parsha and what it's referring to by the shemen zayizach idea.
I said there was no geula, though. He rebuilt the base of Mikdash.
Eventually. Darius II, but that had nothing to do with Achashverosh. Remember,
it was a geula. That came from...
It wasn't a geula at the time. That's the reason why we don't do Hallel on Purim. The Gemara asks, why don't we do Hallel on Purim? One of the answers is the Megillah, reading the Megillah itself is Zuhi Lula. That's considered the Hallel itself. Another answer is that we were outside of Eretz Yisrael, so therefore we didn't want to do it. By Mitzrayim was to lead us into Eretz Yisrael, or was before we had gotten to Eretz Yisrael. The third answer is that Hallel isn't said because, what's it called? We were still in Mitzrayim. We could say we're no longer serving Paro. We're done with Paro. Here, we can't say we're no longer serving Achashverosh. We're still under Achashverosh. We're under the hand of the king in what's it called?
Even
in Babel.
When they rebuilt the second base of Mikdash, they were still under the rule of
the Persians.
And then
and that still happened. Remember, It was 2 years after the Purim story when Darius II became king, and then 2 years into Darius II's reign when they built up the second Beis Hamikdash. Although this might have been a catalyst to the eventual building of it.
Meaning that that was how it was. That's
the Gemara's version of it. Wasn't enough to make a hallel.
Compared to Hanukkah, they went right back to worshiping in the Beis Hamikdash almost right away.
Although Hanukkah is also a little bit strange because we don't know exactly when Hanukkah ended. You know, when did they make the Chag and when did they win the war? The fact that they got the Beis Hamikdash back did not necessarily end the war. So I hear the question, if they didn't necessarily end the war at that moment, if that wasn't the end. But let's assume that was the end of the war. And let's assume that there was something there that from now on they had Yerushalayim. They got Yerushalayim back. It just wasn't enough. But that's what it means. I mean, they were able to do their own thing in the Beis Hamikdash and they were able to bring the Beis Hamikdash back. I think that's how you'd have to answer it. And that would be the difference between them, although there might be a little bit more to it.
Weren't the kingdoms of weren't the Jews under Ahasuerus' kingdom after the Purim story? Weren't they more autonomous than the rest of his empire?
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, for sure not when they moved to Eretz Yisrael, because only 35,000 people went, right, with Ezra and Nehemiah. Only 35,000 people. The rest of the people, they stayed and they were married to Goyim. I mean, we're dealing with people that were right around non-Jews the whole time, so I don't think so. But let's go into another version. Rav Moshe Feinstein takes a different view on what the menorah means and why you only can have Shemen Zayizach for the menorah and not for anything else. He says menorah stands for a teacher of Torah and for a leader of Bnei Yisrael. And to be that, you have to make sure that all your deeds are Zach, that your deeds are pure for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that they're really there without anything that even looks bad. You can't do anything wrong. When I first came back to Chicago, I wasn't even back in Chicago. It was 2005, and it was over Pesach, and we were in a Pesach hotel. My father-in-law had taken my wife and I and my kids to a Pesach hotel. Rabbi Levinson was there, Rabbi Reuben Levinson from Ari Crown. I remember him telling me, he heard, you know, I hadn't had him when I was in sixth grade. He heard that I was going to be a Rebbe, and he said, here's what you need to know. The kids are looking up at you for everything. You can never do anything wrong. You can't do anything wrong. Anything bad that you do, if you say one word, if you do anything that's incorrect, that takes the kid off for life. He learns from that. He sees that, and he starts saying other things. I still remember him telling me that. And that's the idea. I didn't listen to it, but I still remember him telling me that, and knowing that's the quintessential definition of a leader, of somebody who's in charge. Even if a leader or Rebbe does something that looks a little bit bad, and he knows he's doing the right thing, he knows. The ramifications are so extreme, says Rav Moshe. Even the Lamaisi did nothing whatsoever, because you are a pedestal for everyone else. Somebody once wrote to Rav Moshe and said that you're driving on Shabbos. Moshe Chas V'Shalom, how could that be? The guy said, you're driving after the time came, after it was already time for lighting the candles. You're driving after everybody is lighting the candles. People are going to think you're allowed to drive on Shabbos. Moshe said, what do you mean? You're allowed to drive after you light the candles. There's no problem with driving when you light the candles. We hold it Shkia, when Shkia comes in. But he said, from now on, I promise you, because you looked at me that way and you thought something wrong, even though you were wrong, and I was 100% right, I will never drive after candle lighting. That's what Moshe said. Because when you're in that position of leadership, you're a person who's all the way up there, you got to be a little bit special. You got to be something a little bit different. That's Pirkei Avos, Perek Aleph of Mishnah Yud Aleph says, "Hizaru b'maasecha." Be so careful about what you do and where you go. Think of Antigonus Yishtocho. Antigonus Yishtocho said a line over to his Talmidim. Saduk and Bises heard that line. They heard and they thought, "There's no schar and onish in the world," and they went off the derech completely. Saduk became the Saduk and Bises became the Bisusim. They led into the different religions altogether, so to speak. There's different sects of Judaism, all because of one line that Antigonus said. And think about it. It's the third Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. You have to make sure that your Torah is clear and easily understood, that there's no mistakes, and nobody comes out and says to themselves, oh, then I can do whatever I want, or anything like that. Nobody comes out with any big questions. And it's not only the Rebbeim that we're commanding that they have to have that in their mind, that they have to make sure that what they say is perfect. It's Atta Tetzaveh B'nei Yisrael. You have to command B'nei Yisrael that the Shemen Zayizach, that the things that you hear are pure, that there's no sediment in there, that if you have something wrong, ask and figure it out, because don't just figure things out on your own. That's not going to work that way. The idea is lahalos ner tamid. Says Rav Moshe, it's to put in enough oil for it to last all night long. You know, they actually put in the same amount of oil during the summer nights as they would in the winter nights. Winter nights are obviously extremely long. Summer nights are very, very short. But they would put in the same amount of oil that it needed in the winter, the same amount of oil they need for a 14-hour night. They would do the exact same amount of oil for a summer night when it's only 8 or 9 hours or 10 hours or something like that. What's the pshat? Says Rav Moshe, it's the same thing. It's regarding the Rebbe. That a Rebbe has to make sure that no matter who he's teaching, whether it's the sharpest, quickest guy that's there, everybody needs your help. It's sometimes, even though you think to yourself, well, that smart guy, that quick guy over there, he doesn't need my help. He can figure out everything on his own. Sometimes that's the person that needs the most help. Sometimes that's the person that needs the little bit of a push in the back or something like that, because they can't do it on their own, and it looks like they can. Those are the people that need a lot of help. And don't give up on the weakest ones, even when it's the smallest amount of time. Don't give up on those weak ones. You never know what can happen with that person. Who knows? Maybe the weakest one in the class might end up being the greatest one in the class. Who knows what's going to be with that person? It means to teach everybody equally in each way that they need to understand, with just a little bit of effort, a little bit more effort from the Rav's part, in order to work on that person and make him something there. Now they say, at the end of the parsha we speak about the Mizbeach HaZohav. The Mizbeach HaZohav is Mizbeach HaKtoras, which was put inside the Kodesh, which was put inside the Heichal of the Beis HaMikdash, and in the Mishkan. The Mizbeach HaZohav is known as the Kodesh. It's called Kodesh all over the place. But Mizbeach HaNechoshes, the Mizbeach HaNechoshes that was placed outside the Kodesh, outside the Heichal, that big Mizbeach where they put the animals, that Mizbeach was called Kodesh HaKedoshim. And the question is obvious. Rav Moshe asks again, why in the world would you call the Mizbeach that's closer to the Aron Kodesh, you only call it Kodesh? Well, the Mizbeach that's outside, in the courtyard, where anyone could be, that was called Kodesh HaKadoshim. Why is that so much holier? And he says it's also obvious. Again, going into this idea of what the Rebbe is. You want to be holy? Sitting in a base medrash all day makes a person kadosh. He might be a little bit holy. He might be a little bit holy, but you're not that much more. It doesn't become anything more than that. You want to be really holy? Go outside the base medrash and try acting the same way you acted when you were inside the base medrash. Inside the base medrash, it's really easy. Who here is going to have a problem? It's not really that big of a deal. But when you go outside, when you walk outside and you're in the streets and you have other things that are distracting you, try acting that holy out there. If you can act that holy out there, that makes you Kodesh HaKadoshim. So the Mizbeach outside was holy. The Mizbeach inside was not as holy. Rav Moshe points out that this is the famous Maisa that they bring down with the Dubna Magid and the Groh. Everybody remembers this, Maisa. The Groh, once it was right before Yom Kippur, he didn't know what to do kaparach. What did the Groh do all day? He learned all day long in his room. He never went out. He never did anything except for learn. He had a tally in a little notebook of his of every minute of Bittul Torah that he had. I mean, come on. He never did anything wrong. There was nothing. So he didn't know what to do on Yom Kippur. What was he going to say Al Chait for? Al Chait for what? He didn't do anything. So he called him the Dubno Magid. Dubno Magid was a Talmud of the Groz, but he called him and he said, you have to help me. Tell me, what did I do wrong? And Dubno Magid asked his Rebbe, he said, Rebbe, do you allow me to say everything? And the Groz said, tell me anything you want. Just tell me, what did I do wrong? What can I do? So Dubno Magid told him the following. He said, listen, you think you're so good sitting in a room all day long? Think you're so good with your svarim in front of you? Go out into the street for 5 seconds and see how long you last out there. If you're going to go look at a girl, if you're going to hang out with the people down there, if you're going to start speaking nivel peh, if you're going to start saying things that you shouldn't have said or hear lashon hara. Yeah, hanging out in your room while you close your doors, you don't even have the windows open. Yeah, of course you can be a tzaddik when you're in your room. Go outside, go see if you can do something outside. And screamed at the girl. And the girl turned to him and he started crying and he said, you're right. If I'd go outside, I don't know what would happen to me. You're right. If I'd be in the shuk, if I'd be in the marketplace, I have no idea what would end up happening if I would be knocked down by the shuk. But he said, I think that I'm still supposed to be inside. Dudamaki said, I'm not telling you not to be. You're the girl. That I can't do. But he said, but when it boils down to it, the idea is see if you can be, to be kadosh that you can be. To be kodesh akadoshim, you have to be outside. You have to be outside and be able to do that even outside. It's very easy for me to talk, like sitting in Skokie Yeshiva when all the secretaries are over the age of 50. I'm not saying that they're all, you know, I don't want to say anything bad, you know, about the secretaries. I'm not saying that they're, what? Over 50, yeah. Again, I knew I was going to get in trouble in some way or another. Something was going to knock me down for something like this. But like, it's obviously not that hard when I'm walking around and the only people that I'm seeing are gray-haired or no-haired. I mean, that's easy. That's a really, really, yeah. That's much, much easier. It makes things a lot easier for me. Granted, that's not a problem. I don't want to talk about that right now. But it's the people are eating. But like, the fact is, there's a difference. What?
Patty.
And like the Mexican workers. Like, they're tremendous. They're tremendous people. You know, they're great people. And I say thank you and please and all those words, you know, and everything. I'm just, for some reason, I'm not so attracted to them. So there really isn't that big of an issue when I'm in Skokie. Like, what do I have to worry about? And I'm not attracted to the guys. Like, there's really no problem over here. Yeah. There's really no problem. There's really no problem with these types of issues. Those types of things don't come up. So it's very easy for me to say. But that makes you just kadosh. You want to be the kodesh kadoshim. It's to take care of these things when you're outside. That's the idea. And I think I finally understood Shapiana Gemara. I was thinking about this as I wrote this down, and I finally realized, I was like, oh my gosh, that explains the Gemara and Shabbos, Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph. Hillel was on the street, and there were two people that got into an argument. Who can make Hillel angry? So they made a bet with one another, a couple $100, whatever it was, 400, I think it was, 400 golden coins. And they said, whoever's going to make Hillel angry? And a guy came and he said, he started walking in the streets on Erev Shabbos, right before Shabbos, while Hillel was shampooing his hair, washing his hair. He said, Mikan Hillel, Mikan Hillel. Who's Hillel, who's Hillel? Which is derogatory to the Nasi of the nation. To the Nasi of the nation, who's Hillel, who's Hillel? So Hillel, he drives himself off and he goes out to the man. And he says, what can I do for you, my son? And I always thought to myself, why wouldn't the guy go in? Why isn't the guy in the house? Why is he pulling Hillel out to speak to him in the street? Wouldn't you say so? I was always thought that the pshat is that it's just another, you know, a little bit of derogatory. Like, he's just saying, like, I'm not even going to go into you. I'm going to make you come out to me. You know, that's what the guy was thinking. I think it's more than that. He made Hillel come outside into the shuk. He made Hillel walk outside so that he could be influenced by what was going on outside. Because to answer inside the house when you're surrounded by your svarim and you're surrounded by your family and the holy people around you, that's easy. To go out with all the bad ashpos and to still give the same type of answer and to not get angry, that's the idea. That's how you be Kodesh HaGadashim. Hillel succeeded. Hillel did not get angry. That was the idea, but it was a pella that he was able to go all the way that far and it wasn't something there. That was the idea behind Shemen Zayzach. That when somebody has to remember, what does Shemen Zayzach stand for? What is that pure olive oil? It stands for being pure in the sense that a person is as perfect as one can be. Especially if you're in a higher position, in a position of leadership, a person has to be as perfect as me. And unfortunately, we find that the higher of a position you're in, usually the more corrupt you are. It's the exact opposite. And what we're telling you is to try to be the exact opposite. The greatest among our nation is the Kohen Gadol, who is supposed to be the holiest among the nation. The one who goes in on Yom Kippur, he's the only one that goes in on Yom Kippur into the basic in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That's the concept, that we have somebody who is that holy.
That's what I'm confused about. I may have missed something, but why are you saying that the Kodesh HaKadoshim is on the outside? Or
no, it's called, the Mizbeach and the Choshes was called Kodesh HaKadoshim. In the Pasuk. It was in last week's Parsha. So that's the question, why? Why would it be called the Kodesh HaKadoshim while the Mizbeach HaZov inside was only known as Kodesh? That was the Kasha. That was the real Kasha.
It's not on the room. Like, I mean, the it kind of falls apart when you talk. Okay.
Right. It's not, it can't be that literal. But here's the idea. I think I have a little picture over here. I think I brought it. Yeah, I did. All right, good. I'm going to have to bring out the little stones. Little stones of the Choshen. Pasuk says, Vasisa Choshen Mishpat. You make a Choshen Mishpat, a breastplate of judgment that went around the front area of the Kohen. Maise Choshev, it has to be handiwork. Maise Ephota Senu, you make it in the same types of materials that you made the ephod out of, the apron out of. Zov Tchilas Vargamen Slas Shani Vishesh Mazor Tazelso. Gold, the blue wool, the purple wool, the red scarlet threads, and linen all woven together. That's how you have to make it. And it goes through, and you have to have Milesa Bomilos Evan, you have to have the stones on it, right? Everybody knows about the stones. And we also know that the Urim Bitumim inside was folded over, and inside was a little piece of paper with the Urim Bitumim inside, which were the names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So on the stones, we know, were the names of all the Shvatim. Ruvain, Shimon, Levi. And this is the way that it looked. It had three stones, three stones, three stones, three stones. And each one had a different shape. It had Ruvain, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, etc. I'm pretty sure when Don Naphtali got Asher, though that's a bit of a machlokes. But we'll go with that for right now. And each one had the name on the stone, and that was supposed to be it. So the Gemara asked a question. It's in Yuma Ayin Gimel on the base. It said, Ketzad Nasis, how is it possible to make the Choshen with all the light? Well, what did they do exactly. So Rabbi Yochanan says, Osios Boltos. The letters, when they needed to find out an answer for something, they would look at the Urim Bitumen, they would ask the Urim Bitumen, and the letters would stick out. It would stick out from the Choshen, and you could see them like sticking out, like you'd have words on your shirt, and it would stick out if something needed to be there. Reish Lakish says, no, the Osios Mitzarfos. They came together, and they joined together to form another word. It doesn't say where, but maybe they were popped out, maybe it was like a hologram, and they could see them Mitzarfos. They saw them joined together to become a brand new word. That's how the Urim Bitumim worked, and that's how it worked on the Choshen. The Gemara asks, how could that be? If you take all the names of the Shvatim, you'll have every letter, but you don't have a Tzadi. What are you going to do about the Tzadi? How are you going to find the Tzadi? There's no Tzadi in Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Yisachar, Zvulun, Yosef, and Yamin. There's no Tzadi, so what do you do about a Tzadi? So the Gemara says, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov was added on. The letters Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov was added on. I'm sorry? So Yitzchak will take care of that. The Gemara says, well, Tzadi is taken care of by Yitzchak. And then the Gemara asks, well, wait a second. You're still missing a test. You don't have a test. Why don't you, well, where are you going to find the test? The Gemara answers, you're right. We add on other words, Shivtei Yeshurim. Shivtei Yeshurim. So this is how they did it. Each word, each stone had six letters. So Reuven had an Aleph of Avram's name. Shimon had a Beis. Levi is only three letters, so it had three letters of Avram's name, Resh Hey Mem. And then it went on, right? Yehud had a Yud, Don had the Tzchak of Yitzchak's name, and a Yud of Yaakov, and each one all the way through until you got down to Shifti Yeshurun, and Binyamin was the only one that just had his name. Binyamin was written with two Yuds all together. So therefore you had everybody there. The Tzitzit Shimshon asked, and this is not just the Tzitzit Shimshon's question, it's everybody's question that asked on the Gemara. I don't understand. You're asking about a Tzadi, and then you're asking about a test? Why wouldn't you ask about the test first? You ask about where's the test? That's what you should first ask. And then where's the tzadi? That's what you should have done. That's number one. Number two, what about the ches? The Gemara didn't ask about the ches. What about the ches? You're missing a ches as well. You know, by the way, you're also missing a kuf. But I guess that's not that big of a deal because tzadi comes before kuf. That's not that big of a deal. But you're missing kuf, tzadi, ches, and tes in these words. So what are you going to do with those? Why wouldn't the Gemara? Why is the Gemara only asking about tzadi? Why didn't it just say what happened to the tzadi, kuf, ches, and tes?
Once you answer with the tzadi, when you get Yitzchak, you get
the ches and the kuf, right?
So, I understand.
So why not ask about the tes first, the ches first? The ches. Where's the ches? Then you'll say, oh, Avram Yitzchak Yaakov. That takes care of ches, tzadi, and kuf. And then you ask, what about the tes? Why do we ask about the tzadi more than any other letter? Where did the tzadi come in? That's when the Tzitzit Shimshon asks. So he says the following. It's brilliant. The letters of the Shvatim are 50 altogether. If you count up all the letters, Reuven down to Binyamin at the very end, there are 50 letters altogether, 50 letters altogether. The Chizkuni says that the Shemos that were written on the stone represented the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the holy name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The holy name that we know of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Yudkei Vavkei. Now, Yudkei Vavkei can be spelled in many different ways. There are many different forms of that name. Not only you could spell Yud, then Hey, then Vav, then Hey. You could also do Yud, Vav, Hey. You could do all those types of combinations, but you can even spell out the name. Now, Yud, everybody agrees about. Yud is spelled Yud, Vav, Dalet. That everybody agrees with. But Hey is a big kasha. Hey could be spelled Hey Aleph. It could be spelled Hey. And then it could be spelled Hey Yud. Right? And a Vav could be spelled Vav Aleph Vav or a Vav Yud Vav. There are many different ways to be able to to be able to put them through. So in fact, that's where it comes from, that there are different number combinations of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name. There's a 45 letter Shem. If the Hey is with an Aleph and the Vav is with an Aleph, then the amount, the number altogether of Yud, Yud Vav Dalet, Hey Aleph, Vav Aleph Vav, Hey Aleph is 45. If you put in a Yud in somewhere instead, if you put in instead, it becomes a Hey. If you do a Hey instead, then you're adding on another amount, and it ends up being that instead of 45, it becomes 52. If you add on another different way of doing it, it becomes 63. And if you add on another way of doing it, then it becomes 72. And that would be considered one of the numbers of 72. The 72 letter Shem is part of taking the name and writing Yud Vav Dalet, Hey Yud, Vav Yud Vav, Hey Yud. And if you write it that way, that equals 72 altogether. So they thought that since there's a holy name on the Choshen, and there's 50 letters of the Shvatim, then you need to get up to, you're done with 45. It can't be the 45 letter Shem, but it could be the 52 letter Shem. So they had to bring it up to the 52 letter Shem. How many letters would you put on the Choshen? You had 50 letters of the Shvatim. You only need two letters. What two letters did they put on? Ches and Tes. says the Gemara. Fine. Let's say you had the 50 letters and the other two letters to form the name, to form the number of 52. But you're still missing a tzadi. So the first question the Gemara asks is, what are you going to do about the tzadi? Why are you going to understand that? So the Gemara said, no, that's wrong. We didn't put on the ches and the tes. We added on Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov is all together how many letters? 13. 50 plus 13 is what? 63. That's the 63-letter name of Hashem. It was the 63-letter name of Hashem. So the Gemara says, that's perfect. That answers the Tzadi, that answers the Ches, that answers the Kuf. But what are you going to do with the Tes? Says the Gemara, what about the Tes? What are you going to do about the Tes? You can't make it 64. There's no such shame of a Kaddish Baruch. What are you going to do? So the Gemara says, we add on another two words. Shivte Yeshurin. Shivte Yeshurin are nine letters altogether. Yeshurin is spelled Yud, Shin, Vav, Resh, Nun. If you add on nine letters to 63, what do you come out with? 72. You have the 72-letter shame. So now, if you figure it out, you go all the way through, you can figure out if there are 6 letters per stone, and there are 12 stones altogether, 6 times 12 is 72 letters. And that's how they ended up having that it represented, says the Chizkuni, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's why the Gemara asked it in that order. Because the Ches and the Tes, they thought were already on in order to be the 52-letter shame. So we only asked about the Tzadi. Once we added on the extra letters of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, then you no longer could ask about those Ches and the Tes, but you still have a problem with the Tes. And that's when we added on the 9 letters, and we ended up being 72. But the Chassam Sofer answers differently. He answers, there's 2 ways to translate this line. Listen to what it says. V'avonim tiyeno, al Shmos b'nei Yisrael. Yes, you can read Hebrew. Read this line. Vahavonim.
You understand?
I do understand.
Yeah, come on. See it right there. Vahavonim.
Vahavonim tien.
Tien.
Al Shmos b'nei Yisrael.
Just right there. Right there. Well, how do you translate that?
The stones.
Yeah.
Will be on the names of the Yisrael.
What in the world does that mean? Should it be, and the names of b'nei Yisrael were on the stones? Yeah. Should be the opposite way. Shmos b'nei Yisrael tiena al ha'avonim. But it doesn't read that way. It says, Va'avanim tien al shmos b'nei Yisrael. And the stones should be on the names of b'nei Yisrael, says the Chassam Sofer, because there's 2 ways to translate avanim. They understood that the names of b'nei Yisrael were on the avanim. That's obvious. Obvious. Where else are you going to put them? They understood that. But here's the pshat. They're saying you should write something else aside from the names of b'nei Yisrael. You should put something else on the stones. So what can you put on the stones? One pshat is, what you should put on is the names of the stones. Put the names of the stones on the stones themselves. So instead of Reuven just being Reuven, it would be Reuven and Oden, because that was the name of the stone. Shimon will be Pitzda, the emerald. Levi will be Barekes, the crystal. Yehuda would be Nofach, the carbuncle, if anybody knows what a carbuncle is. Dun would be Sapir, sapphire. And they'd have those words, Sapir, it would be written on the stone itself. So that's great, says the Gemara. If you're going to translate it as Avanim, then you're going to everything's going to be really, really good. That means you'll have the Avanim on there, and then you'll have the extra letters that you're missing. Because Pitada has a Tes. You have, what else was it? Achlama has a Ches. And you'll be able to take care of these problems. Says the Gemara, that works out well, except you're missing one thing. And Barekis, by the way, would be the Kuf. You'd have the Kuf inside there also. But the Gemara says, you're still missing a Tzadi. What are you going to do with a Tzadi? Even if you write all the names of the Shvatim and all the names of the stones, there's no Tzadi among the stones. So the Gemara said, if you translate Avanim, that the Avanim, the names of the stones, will be on top of the names of B'nai Yisrael, that the names of the stones will be with the names of B'nai Yisrael on the stones, you got a problem. You're still missing a Tzadi, says the Gemara in Yuma. What are you going to do about the Tzadi? So what does the Gemara answer? You're translating it wrong. Avanim doesn't mean stones. It's a notrico. It's an abbreviation for Av Uben. Avanim can be Av Uben. So it's referring to not only having the Bunim, the children of Bnei Yisrael, on the stones, but have the Avos written on the stones as well. So what do you write on the stones? Avram Yitzchak Yaakov. That takes care of the Tzadi, and that answers what it means. Well, Avanim and the Avos should also be written on the Shmos Bnei Yisrael. That's the remez that we're trying to give over here, says the Chassam Sofer. But then you got a problem, because you're still missing a Tes. What are you going to do about the test? Says the Gemara, Shifti Yishurin. That's what the Gemara was talking about. So the Gemara assumed we were putting the names of the stones on, because that's Pashup Shat in the Pasuk, and the Gemara answers, no, we're putting Avosu Banim on, and that answers the Pasuk. That you just have to say, Avanim means Avosu Banim, and then you still get a problem when we say, okay, don't worry, Shifti Yishurin, and that takes care of everything. Rav Shor says an awesome thing that we learned from this, and we'll end with this.
Maybe you write, maybe when it means stones on the names, is that they would write the names on the the cloth that's beneath the choshen, and then put the stones on top of the names, and the names would shine through.
And it would shine through. There is a pshat that says something like that.
Or maybe
yeah.
It was written on
the I just read that pshat. That's a very, very good call. That was written behind it. No, yeah. For sure, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the 72-letter name, was written behind in the Urim and Tumim. The Urim and Tumim, according to Ramban, were names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That was an answer. Right, you're talking about actually for the stones to be able to come through. No, it clearly was written on the stones because of the shamir worm, because it says specifically how to make them. That's in the Gemara, that the shamir worm is used in order to write it.
Maybe they're both on there.
Abu Bain is written. No, it doesn't say that anywhere. I mean, for sure the Gemara doesn't say it. The Gemara says the Avram Yisrael Yaakov, and there's no machlokas in the Gemara whatsoever. But there's something to think about.
There's Shinti,
the Shvatim of Yeshurin, which is another name of Yaakov, you know. Yaakov, had Yisrael, Yaakov, and Yeshurin were the three names that were used for him. So Shifti Yeshurin was put in top. Why is not Shifti Yisrael is a good question.
Well, I'm saying, why is that? I mean, where
I can't tell you. I think the Rashi answered why specifically Yeshurin, because Yisrael was a name, I forgot what the difference is, but he explained something, I just don't remember it offhand. But Rav Shurin says a tremendous lesson from this entire idea. What's the point in the stones with the names of the Shvatim? They have to be on the stones? Like, well, what is that teaching us? He says like this. He says, a human king prides himself, not with gold and silver. I mean, wearing gold and silver is not that big of a deal. How does a human king show his greatness? From precious stones. From the precious stones in his crown, in his crown. That's the idea that he shows how great he is. Why is that, like, better than gold and silver? Gold and silver are more expensive, usually. I mean, it could be you'll find a precious stone that's not like that, but why pride yourself in stones? Why is it so great? That's beautiful, Rav Shur. Where do these stones come from? A crystal. Rubies and all these things. They come from the ground, from stones that don't look so special. If you would see crystal in the ground, you'd look at it and you'd be like, oh, that's just a dirty rock. So what does the king do? He has skilled workers that work and hack off all the pines and shine and shine and shine these stones until they mamish become beautiful. Until they become the crystals that we see, or the diamonds that we see, or the carbuncles that we see all over the place. Until they really, really shine it through. It shows that he was willing to work hard and have these workers work to be able to make them beautiful showpieces, something that's going to be there. It's like showing off a parrot to someone. A parrot that talks and saying, hey, look at my parrot talks. And the guy says, what's the difference? All people talk. No, but obviously, it's different when a parrot talks, because birds don't usually talk, right? And if this parrot talks, that means it's very special. This is a different type of a stone. People look at this stone, and they see what the king did, and they saw that something that looked like nothing in the ground, like a piece of garbage on the ground, like absolutely nothing, look, if you shine it, and you do all this work, and you keep working and hacking away at it, look what it can become. It can become this beautiful ruby, this beautiful emerald. Look at what this can possibly be. That's the pshat, says Rav Shur. On the stones were the shemos of the shvatim. Meaning, if you work on yourself, if a person works on themselves, your beauty can shine like these stones shine. The same way that we made these stones out of stones that look like nothing in the ground. A person can make himself out of a body that really is nothing. You could be metar yourself, you could purify yourself and make something awesome out of yourself. That's why the names are there. Specifically to show you that we should act like the king acts when it comes to these types of stones. Like the Kohen Gadol does when it comes to these stones. We should work and work and work on ourselves until we hack away all the impurities, all the garbage and everything else, and make it into the purest stone that you can possibly be. We're going to stop with that for right now. Have a good job, everybody.